to talk about ideas related to cold atoms in particular, then also molecules related to condensed matter physics and quantum information ideas. And these are the people that are sort of involved in the kind of things that I've been talking about here. But let me first of all somehow get a perspective right of, you know, from the quantum optics, atomic physics point of view, how this conference here sort of looks like. This conference here is about topological quantum computing. I should first of all say that in the context of quantum optics, we have, of course, quantum computing ideas and proposals, and they're actually quite far in the lab. There's ideas like trapped ions, where one takes, for example, ions stored in an ion trap, and you can use the internal states as a spin. And Rainer Platt in Innsbruck, for example, has built one of these ion traps and has shown entanglement of 8 ions, and he sees lifetime of entangled states, for example, of about 1 minute. So these things are actually at the moment quite promising. So what I find exciting in this context of this conference here is really ideas that have to do with topological sort of exotic phases. And of course, the system of interest in this context are called atoms or then also molecules in optical lattices. And I will tell you afterwards a little bit more detail about these kind of ideas. Quite often these things are now sold under the word quantum simulator. And I put this thing under a quote because I'm never really sure if I like this name or not. People are interested in the moment in, for example, building systems like this with controllable parameter that would correspond to Hubbard models, for example, simulating high TC superconductivity and all of these things. There would also be, besides this analog version of the digital version of this thing. And the question, of course, is in the long run is that if these kind of systems here can be used in order to mimic exotic material and then also exotic quantum phases. And if somebody asked me what maybe quantum optics will look like in, I don't know, 10 years from now, maybe what we will do at this point is that we sort of take systems like this, make some artificial materials of this type, and can design, sort of learn how to handle individual excitations like generating anions and then doing all of these grading operations, sort of a kind of a quantum optics in this context. I don't see that this will be particularly useful in the context of topological quantum computing, replacing some of these ideas. And the reason is that the gap in these systems here turns out to be extremely small. And so you're not really protecting, I mean, like you would do in a condensed matter context. Okay, so as an atomic physics or quantum optics person, what I'm interested in is much more questions coming from the atomic physics side, on one hand based on what's realistic experimentally, but also what will come in the near future. To come up with ideas how to design new kind of Hamiltonians and what new opportunities are offered by experimental results, or sort of experimental future developments. And have become a particular interest in polar molecules of the last 1.5 years. And all of these things that you can see in the left-hand side, like cold atoms in optical lattices, Wigner crystals of trapped ions for quantum computing, cavity QED, and all of these things can be done in these systems here, polar molecules. You know, all of them actually appear in one system over here. But these systems offer, I would say, great advantages relative to the other things, you know, to atoms, for example, building certain Hubbard models in the context of atoms, essentially because these molecules can have a permanent dipole moment, and this permanent dipole moment, on one hand, gives rise to very large, dipole-dipole long-range couplings. And it also can be manipulated using microwave fields, and then decoherence, for example, in these systems can be relatively small. So all of these things which are over here can be done here, but maybe even in a better way. And this is sort of the starting point for us. And here's an outline of my talk. What I would like to do is this. I would like to start out by a brief review of some of these Hubbard ideas coming from the atomic side, then say a few things about polar molecule, telling you about the corresponding physics, then giving you as one short example this idea of making a spin toolbox like building a Kitaev model. And we believe that actually the numbers for these kind of things with these polar molecules seem to work out. So we can essentially engineer any 2D spin system that we want to have. But that's a little bit black and white, but this is sort of roughly what the statement is. And work that we're doing at the moment corresponds to Hubbard models where we can engineer three-body interactions in the way which is indicated here. So if you have molecules hopping on the lattice side, say a honeycomb lattice or whatever the underlying lattice is, then we know now how to engineer Hamiltonians, or sort of they seem to come out very naturally in what we do, that have not only hopping terms, but of course also two-body interactions between two off-site, this would be nearest neighbor couplings here, but we can also now engineer a situation where we get three-body terms that are relatively large. So we can have large three-body terms, and the two-body terms are tunable. In particular, we can switch them off, we can make them positive, negative, and we can make them much smaller than these terms over here. And this is sort of a kind of Hamiltonians which come out from these systems. And I guess that you as a community might be interested in sort of, you know, seeing what Hamiltonians come out naturally for these systems, rather than, so to say, really by brute force techniques going in and try to design some sort of a model that people have studied for whatever reason in the past in the literature. I asked actually Chetan Nayak if it was okay if Hans-Peter Büchler, who is here in the audience, would actually present the second part of the talk, which is the part down here, and he said yes, that's fine. So I will actually give the first part up to here, and then Hans-Peter Büchler, who is here in the audience, will explain this part, because this was essentially his project over the last maybe 6 or 7 months or something like that. But let me also sort of complement now this outline by two more ideas that we are working on at the moment. One is this, that we just recently published a paper on replacing the optical lattices by a new system, which is dipolar crystals. And the basic idea there is this one, that if I take a polar molecule and I align it in an electric field, I'm able to get the dipolar crystal. And the reason why this crystal is actually quite interesting is that in contrast to the crystals that one has as a Wigner crystal with, for example, trapped ions, now you have a dipolar crystal based on induced dipole moments, and it also goes down like 1 over r cubed. So the bottom line is, for example, that apart from being able to tune all of these parameters and studying, for example, the phase transition between the superfluid and the crystalline phase and all of these things, this provides a new kind of a crystal structure that actually the distance between these molecules can be roughly, say, the order to say something like maybe 100 nanometers. And so what we're studying also at the moment is ideas like you might now take atoms and put them inside of these kind of new crystals that we have. And then, of course, you would again now obtain Hubbard models. This is, so to say, this would be the pillars, so to say, sitting here and here and here, in this triangular lattice of these molecules over here. And this would be the basis of making a new Hubbard model. And you can see sort of a graphene-type structure coming out in the honeycomb lattice. You can put in atoms that have spin and all of these things. So I see this as a new playground for engineering new kind of Hubbard models, and one of the side effects of all of this is there would also be phonons in the system here. Maybe Hans-Peter, when he gives his talk at the end, can also say something about the ring exchange. We wrote a paper together, people down here, Matthew Fisher and so on, about 1.5 years ago, on engineering ring exchange with atoms in the optical lattice, but this is sort of a side remark maybe at this point. Okay, so let me then maybe start out with some short review of cold atoms in an optical lattice and these Hubbard models. The basic idea is actually quite simple. It's sort of copied from what the people did in the old days of laser cooling. If you take counterpropagating laser light waves, you get, of course, an interference pattern in the intensity, which is seen by cold atoms that move in this lattice as essentially a trapping potential for the center of mass motion. As a consequence, there will be Bloch bands. There will be a lowest Bloch band, the excited Bloch bands up here. I will not really talk about the excited Bloch band up here. It turns out that if you start to put the numbers, you can describe cold atoms moving on this lattice essentially by a Hubbard model here, where the essential feature is the fact that we got actually tunable parameters. You can see that we have a kinetic energy here, the Hopping term, and we have an interaction energy, which is the on-site interaction here due to the repulsion or maybe attractions of atoms hopping on this lattice. But the nice thing is that by making this intensity larger, you make the lattice deeper, the on-site interaction will grow, but of course the tunneling barrier will also grow, so this means that you can change the ratio between the kinetic and the potential energy, and this allows you in the time-dependent way to go, for example, through a superfluid mode insulator phase transition and these kind of ideas. So this was our original idea. And of course, the remarks I should add is this fact that in this context here, we have a microscopic understanding of these kind of Hamiltonians, so they're not phenological in any sense. And we can control and engineer these kind of interactions here by the external light fields. The relation to quantum computing in these optical lattices is made at the point, for example, when you start to put in atoms that have maybe spin up and spin down, so you start to fill the lattice with qubits or with spin 1/2 systems, and the same mechanism that I said before, like, you know, making the lattice deeper, allows you then via preparing a mod phase to, for example, fill your lattices with qubits. So if you would like to talk about engineering a spin models, the mod phase of having, so to say, one atom per lattice side, and then having these things interact maybe by some long-range interactions is really the starting point. Now, these things, of course, do exist in the lab in the meantime, but let me just point out the relation now here. sort of these things are interesting both from this condensed matter point of view, engineering these strongly correlated systems and exotic quantum phases, but also from a quantum computing point of view, you can make cluster states, I mean something that I will not talk about here. Now, the reason why people at the moment are interested in all of that is, of course, that following our papers, there have been experiments by Manuel Bloch, Esslinger, Denschner, Grimm, and all of these people here. And people are now doing these kind of experiments in the lab. So this is something that works in the lab. And I think it's sort of time now to think of the next generation, you know, with how we can maybe replace these optical lattices by something which is better, that gives us certain advantages in a certain context. Let me also mention here that in doing these optical lattices, we have what we call this whole Rho-Hubbard toolbox that we have time dependence that we can put in. This is in condensed matter something really completely new, different dimensions by simply switching our laser intensities, various lattice configurations. We know how to generate very strong, sort of effective artificial magnetic fields that you would have some phases on one of these plaquettes that you have here. They can engineer this again using laser phases that we can put on some of these hopping rates in these Hubbard models. We can make spin-dependent lattices. If you got a spin up and a spin down, you can engineer potentials that depend on the spin, so you can get different hopping amplitudes, or you can engineer stuff like, for example, laser-induced hoppings by having a bipartite lattice and just have the laser sort of jump, you know, make the atoms jump between these different lattices. So there's a whole bunch of things out there, and quite often condensed matter people then sort of take this as the situation, but we can write down any Hubbard model, whatever we want. At the end, these cold atoms people know anyway how to do all of these things. There's a warning over here. Namely, I would like to point out that these hopping matrix elements that we talk about here and these on-site interactions, they have certain energy scales, which in this case of the atoms tend to be relatively small. And so when you start deriving effective Hamiltonians and you go to your nth-order perturbation theory, and at the end, I see, for example, sometimes in these papers, couplings coming out that are of the order of something like Hertz. Okay, you have to start to compare these things with the decoherence timescales in the system, which is also very slow. But one should be a little bit critical in this context. So this is not, so to say, the license to write down any Hubbard model and then say, well, the cold atoms people how to know it, how to do it anyway. Let me add one small feature here that I would like to discuss now in a little bit more detail as one, so to say, new ideas that are coming along. What has been missing so far in optical lattices has been ideas how to do single site addressing, or to say something a little bit more general. Can we make, for example, a lattice that would be not be a lambda lattice or lambda over two lattice that we would normally get using light, lambda, the wavelengths of the light? Can you do something like a sub-wavelength lattice? And can you also do things like individual addressing of the atoms on the lattice, for example, in order to measure some interesting correlation function that you want? And I think in the next generation of these experiments, this will be implemented. And let me tell you what the basic, just one example, the sub-wavelength lattice, what the corresponding underlying physical ideas are. I think that this will be a very important step for being able to identify, for example, both in terms of in an operational sense, being able to go in and then maybe flip the spin of one of these atoms or molecules in here, but also, you know, by making a sub-wavelength lattice, making much smaller lattices, which at the end of the day allow you to do lattices that have much larger couplings in terms of hopping and on-site interaction, which would allow you to go to higher temperatures than you have at the moment. So all of the time scales will become much faster, and then of course some of the things we look at the moment as being unrealistic may become realistic. So let me just show you these ideas in a little bit more detail that gives you kind of the flavor of how we can engineer these kind of systems here. So how do we get the sub-wavelength lattice? Well, I said before that if I take an alkali atom, you know, I might have a spin up, spin down state here in the ground state. Let me forget about hyperfine structure at the moment. And as I said before, we can do spin-dependent lattices that the blue, the spin down, you know, sees one lattice and the red another one. We know how to move these lattices relative to each other. I mean, we proposed this some time ago, and Emanuel Bloch did experiments. And based on this entanglement, for example, by moving optical lattices was seen and a little cluster state was made. Something similar could be done if you go to alkaline earth atoms. This is something which is coming along as one of the next few systems where you have some metastable excited states. And again, if you use this, and this is, so to say, the spin down and the spin up state, this is an optical transition, and people are now building optical clocks based on these things, you can get a very similar situation. So let me now take this situation and show you how I can get sub-wavelength lattices that are even addressable on the sub-wavelength scale. The idea is actually very simple. Let me just take my atom, which is in the ground state, which has a lattice like this. This is the green one over here, is a function of position, and the one up here, which is this lattice that I've moved in such a way that it just complements the lower one. So you can see that they're sort of breathing out of phase. And this is the scale x here, and this is lambda over 2, which is the wavelength of my light. Lambda is the wavelength of my light. Now, what I would like to do is this, that I would like to go in and put in now a probe laser beam that connects the ground to the excited state. And you can see what will happen is the following, that if I put in a probe light field, if an atom sits at this position over here, what I do is this, that if an atom, for example, moves along on this upper curve here, and it comes to this point, if I put in a probe light here, then there will be sort of this state plus one photon will be the same energy as the excited state, so there will be an avoided crossing. So this means that if I diagonalize this system again, now putting in this probe light field, you can see that I get an effective system out, which has now these adiabatic curves, and provided that my coupling here, that I call omega naught, this Rabi frequency, is sufficiently large, I will get now a new set of adiabatic curves. There, of course, when an atom is somehow moving along, it's changing its identity from ground to excited state, ground state. But you can also see what we achieved here. We achieved, first of all, that we divided this lattice over here by 2, so we have a lambda over 4 lattice, at the expense, of course, also, that if you had original lattice height V0, of course, we have also half the height. So this means by putting in an additional probe frequency, we can get a sub-wavelength lattice, in this case lambda over 4, but at the expense of just putting in more laser power. Now, our usual argument is that laser power is very cheap, so in this sense, something like this is in principle doable. Now, let me sort of go back to this point that I had over here and sort of repeat now this story. By putting it now here, instead of one of these probe laser beams, several of them at the same time. But before I do that, let me move on by just showing you this example. Let me take this slope out here that I have maybe in the ground in an excited state, which has a certain slope of a certain distance, and I'm putting now in here a whole frequency comp. And then, of course, the argument is now quite obvious that if I, for example, have this thing, and I start to put in now more and more of these probe fields, you can see that what I can do is this, I can sort of subdivide the slope that I have over here in order to get little wells, and each of these wells is associated, of course, that these excitations here put in little avoided crossings. But now you can also see what the point is of the whole story. The point of the story is this, that if I go in with a certain frequency, and I can shift my frequency around of these things, I can, of course, make these lattices that I have here move around. And by putting in maybe a different Rabi frequency for these couplings, I can also shift the height of these potentials around. And of course, at this point, we have sort of made a flat bottom trap, subdividing the wavelengths. And now you can see that by putting in different Rabi frequencies, we get, so to say, little wells over here that we can shift around and move around and give different depths. And we are doing these things on the sub wavelength scale. We call this thing an inverse piano in the following sense, that if I press a key on a piano, a sound comes out. We are putting a sound in, and then this key, you know, which is this thing that goes up and down here, is pressed. Okay? So in this sense, we are playing piano, but sort of an inverse piano here.
What is your wavelength here? Is it the whole
Well, okay, at the moment, let me show you now that we just do this thing now, illustrated here for the example of now two of these probe beams that we are putting in. In doing that, of course, I get now this structure down here, so we have a lambda over 6 lattice, and you can see how it can continue. And you can see that the lattice is no longer so regular, but essentially what I can do is that I can move all of these things, at least on the scale lambda over 2, up and down that I want. This sort of gives you the flavor of, you know, some of these massage ideas that we can do with these lattices. But there may be sort of a new type of optical lattice on the horizon that goes down to maybe, you know, scales that are 100 nanometers or something like this. Then you're sort of entering nanophysics, or maybe atomic physics should finally get some nanophysics money or so. Okay, let me now switch over to polar molecules as a new system that will come. And the reason why we got interested in polar molecules is that, first of all, on the time scale of something like maybe 2 years or so, I would expect that people will have cold polar molecules in the lab in the form that they're able to do these kind of things that we're talking about here. There are several groups around that are trying to do these things. First of all, people like Dave DeMille and Junye at Yale and also Jilla, who try to produce these cold molecules by what we call photo association, and I will explain these things down here. But there's also different ways, like what Doylen, Gerhard Meyer does in Berlin, and also Rempe, they try to go via, for example, buffer gas cooling. But let me just give you the flavor of what these ideas are, of how these cold molecules are produced, so that you can see why, at the end, it makes sense that I talk about, for example, mod insulator ideas of cold optical, of cold molecules in an optical lattice. So one way of getting cold molecules is this, that suppose you are one of these experimentalists who have maybe a two species Bose-Einstein condensate in the lab. So they have a condensate of a certain type of particle, which is here red, and the other one is here blue. And suppose that these people have done a mod insulator quantum phase transition in such a way that you get one blue and one of these red molecules and one of these latticides here. Then what you can try to do is this, they are sort of like in a little cup over here, like doing chemical reactions, and now you can try to take the binding energy out of the system by essentially using a laser that takes these two states here and tries to connect these things here to the ground state. There's a lot of questions about Frank Compton factors and all of these things that we don't want to discuss here, but people like Dave DeMille have shown part of these things already in the lab. So you can see that there will be sort of like in a chemical reaction, people will be able to take these two atoms and fuse them to a ground state molecule, eventually, of course, hopefully going all the way down to the ground state down here. And this leaves us with the question then of having the molecules in the electronic and vibrational ground state, and then we have to talk about rotational excitations that are sitting in these latticides. So we have a mod insulator of molecules that will right away come out from these systems. Okay, so the question is now, what can you do with these things? And so let me just tell you in a few words what this spectroscopy is of these polar molecules, because this is afterwards the building block, you know, understanding the rotational excited states, what we do here, will be the building block then of engineering interesting Hubbard models, because what we will do at the very end is this, that we have some high energy degrees of freedom, there are maybe some rotational excited states, and by going in with microwave fields, we will be able to somehow tailor these excited states in such a way that the low energy theory that comes out for these effective Hamiltonians will be a certain Hubbard model or will be a certain kind of a spin model that we would like to have. So in this sense, let me tell you a few words about this spectroscopy, at least to the extent that you can understand the basic physics. And the example that I always like to explain here is the one of calcium fluoride. Maybe it's exactly the molecule that will not be produced by photoassociation, but it's a good example for what I would like to illustrate here. In this case, you have calcium, for example, which has two outer electrons, and then there's fluoride here, and this will grab one of these electrons, essentially leaving a core here behind and one loosely bound electron out here. So you can see that this kind of a molecule almost looks like an alkali atom. So in terms of the optics, you know, there's a single electron out here, and you can excite these things with a laser. But you can also see that there's an unbalance in the charge here. This unbalance in the charge leads to the fact that these have an electric dipole moment. And actually, these dipole moments can be relatively large, and you have strong couplings over here. But this dipole moment will, of course, talk to microwave radiation. So you have the combination of optical radiation. This allows trapping, but also excitations of converting qubits into optical photons. But also here microwave radiation, which has rotational excitations, and the combination of this. Actually, you know, based on this, we wrote some papers together with Rob Schoelkopf and Dave DeMille on how to use these kind of polar molecules as a storage device when you couple this thing to, for example, a solid state quantum processor like what Rob Schoelkopf has with his cavity QD Cooper pair boxes coupled kind of ideas. But we want to talk about molecules here. So these molecules have electric dipole moment and they will rotate, and this is this angular momentum n that we have up here. I should also remark that, of course, in the case of neutral atoms, you will also have, you know, microwave excitations, but they correspond to hyperfine transitions, and they are about three orders of magnitude smaller than this thing here. So the fact that this is electric means that all of these interactions are significantly larger than we would ever be able to get in the case of an atomic system. And this is the reason why it's interesting. Now, this outer electron, of course, also has spin. So if you want to look for a qubit, I mean, here it is. This could be the spin, for example, of the system. But of course, there may be additional complications, like there could also be a nuclear spin, which at the moment I would like to ignore. But so it can be sort of summarized that the high energy excitations, high energy and the quote of our system will be that we have a molecule that can sit in the ground state and then has rotational excitations going up here. And it is important to realize that these rotational excitations are, first of all, in the microwave domain. And spontaneous emission from these excited states down here is essentially negligible if you ignore black body radiation. If you put in black body radiation, the the coherence, if you would call this thing here a qubit, would be in the rate of about maybe 1 hertz. So in principle, these things could also live for many, many minutes and even longer, even hours, in terms of the normal in the cold environment for going down here. So decoherence in these systems is from the very beginning small. But as I noted before, you have strong electric dipole moments going up here that you can couple now to microwave radiation. So in this sense, all of these excited states, which by the way are unharmonic because this is a rotor, which is a very nice feature. So if you put in some microwave here, you don't couple here to these states here, they can be used. They can be used in order to tailor at the end interesting interactions without paying the price of decoherence. If you start to add spin to these systems, you know, then of course the ground state will be a spin up and a spin down. But like in the case of an atom, you get for the excited state interactions like the coupling of spin, in this case the rotation, similar to the spin orbit coupling that we have in the case of normal atoms, so there will be a splitting. But what you can do in this sense is that if this is a spin qubit down here, you can see that by exciting with microwave radiation, you're sort of coupling here the spin to the rotation degrees of freedom, but the rotation degree of freedom is your dipole moment. And this at the very end allows you to convert spin to the coupling to a dipole moment, but this thing will of course interact at the very end in a very strong way with dipole-dipole interactions. And dipole-dipole interactions, of course, are if I take two molecules sitting on two adjacent lattice sites, maybe this could be an optical lattice, and I've obtained them using these mod insulator ideas by photo association, you would have a strong coupling here because these electric dipole moments are so large. And you should also see that it goes down like 1 over r cubed. So in this sense, at least, it is a long-range interaction. Normally, in atomic physics, we just have some kind of delta functions or pseudo-potentials, which are really short-range. But so it is strong, and it has angular dependence, and it is long-range. These are exactly features which now can be used in order to do some interesting Hubbard physics or also spin physics. So let me now come to this point here of telling you a little bit about this toolbox for spin models. At the very end, one of the models that we could show how to engineer was this Kidaev model number 2, you know, the one on this honeycomb lattice with this X, X, Y, Y, and the CC coupling. But I will essentially illustrate these things by a much simpler model, which is you give me any 2D plane here, and we assume that we have molecules sitting here. And for example, you would like to see something like an X, X, CC coupling, so that's an Ising coupling here, but which is highly anisotropic. You know, by putting in an appropriate amount of microwave radiations, we can sort of engineer these kind of systems. Yeah, so let me go over these things quickly and then come to the next part, which is then Hans Peter's one, which will be on the engineering three-body interactions, which will be based on some similar principles. Okay, so what's the claim here? The claim is this, that we have molecules sitting on the lattice, and we write down any Hamiltonian which is symmetric for these two spin couplings here. But you can essentially specify these coefficients, including their range, at least to some extent, and you have a certain spin and space anisotropy, which is built into this Hamiltonian. So simply specify it like, as I said before, the XXCC coupling. And the claim is now that by putting in appropriate fields, we can get these Hamiltonians as our low energy effective theories. And the motivation, as I said, is of course to make models like this, with an XXCC coupling, but also this Kidaev model here, where you have these XXCC and YY couplings here coming up. And so as I said before, we have a certain procedure how we can actually generate exactly these kind of models in the lab, arguing that all of the remaining couplings are relatively small. And this is sort of the physical implementation of these things. You can see now molecules sitting in a certain way on the lattice that I don't really want to explain. So let me just give you the physical intuition and then show you a few slides that outline, you know, how the more quantitative analysis go, even though maybe you're not the audience who would like to learn a lot about molecular physics here. Yeah. The basic physics is the following, and the basic idea. If I take two atoms that are fixed at certain positions, and these distances may be something like lambda over 2, as I said before, in the standard optical lattice, then you have here the spin degree of freedom in your rotational ground state of the molecule. So this is your qubit, or this is your spin 1/2. It would be easy to generalize these things to higher order spins, so maybe you want to realize something like a spin 1, you could take some hyperfine level down here, whatever. Now, if I put in microwave radiation, you can see the excited rotation state has a splitting proportion to the spin orbit coupling. So as I said before, in doing this excitation here, what we do is this, that we couple the spin down here via the microwave field to the rotation N. But the rotation n is nothing else but the orientation of your dipole moment, and you can do this thing for this molecule and for this one over here. And now you have the dipole-dipole interaction sitting in between here, which is an anisotropic long-range and relatively strong interaction. And then what we do is this, that we eliminate these excited states in the sense of an effective field theory, projecting everything down here on the ground state, and ask ourselves, you know, by adjusting these couplings, the control of the microwave field, we can, you know, make these couplings stronger or weaker, in just whatever you would like to have in this context. We get, at the end, essentially a Hamiltonian out, where we get for these two-body couplings, you know, terms like that. You might wonder what will happen to three-body couplings and so on. Afterwards, Hans-Peter will tell you a little bit more details about these things. Well, if you really would like to see some molecular details, I'm not sure that you really want to see that. I mean, here would be some Bohn-Oppenheimer curves of you know, molecules sitting a certain distance, and this would be all of these rotational excitations here. And then if you focus in on one of these here, it would be like that. And if you put in stuff like, you know, all of these spin orbit couplings, I mean, these are exactly the kind of things that one thinks why you never wanted to do molecular physics. Yeah? But the key point in this whole story is this, that in these Born-Oppenheimer curves, essentially what an optical lattice does, it keeps two molecules at a certain distance. So you can see that by going in with a microwave field that sort of, you know, touches maybe close to one of these levels up here, you can ask yourself, what does it mean if I couple closely to one of these levels? The physical meaning is that if you do this adiabatic elimination, and you go here to these excited states at a certain distance, that each of these levels associated in a molecular structure has, because of this competition of spin orbit couplings with a dipole-dipole interaction, a certain kind of a spin texture. So it turns out that by doing that, you can engineer basically, you know, by putting in the appropriate microwave field, any kind of coupling that you would like to have. This is sort of the basic idea. There's a lot of details that maybe you don't really want to know at the moment. And the second remark I should make is this, that if I would take, for example, a larger distance like the one out here, like you would have it on the diagonal versus the, you know, like here, if you look at the square lattice, you can look at these ones over here, and also these things over here. So let me compare this one to this one over here. So this simply would mean that if you got two molecules sitting at a different distance, maybe one is sitting like this, and maybe one a little bit a larger distance. This would be diagonal, one across the square. You can see that while one is resonant, the other one is off-resonant, and under certain conditions that I don't want to explain now here, you can sort of argue that this one out here is actually off-resonance and does not really contribute to the spin interaction that we were doing here before. Take certain conditions on the detuning and on the splitting that we have over here. So it means that you can also engineer the range of the interaction. And the last point is that we cannot only do these things for a single frequency that we are shining in, but we can also do it for a multi-frequency field. So if you have a certain amount of spin texture, you can sort of superimpose these spin textures in a way to construct the general models. This is sort of the idea. So the sort of summary of all of this is that, you know, if you write down interactions that you like, spin models in 2D, whatever it is, you know, there's an associated recipe on the molecular side. You know what kind of polarization to put in, what kind of resonance to pick in order to get these kind of models out. And the corresponding couplings, it turns out, are relatively large. Okay? So in this sense, we know how to do any spin model, and of course the future would be something like that, sort of doing baby steps towards this manipulating maybe anions or something like that to do braiding operations. But if you combine, you know, being able to make this model, which is at the moment a little bit futuristic, maybe a Kidaev model with the possibility of this local addressing. I think there's several elements that we already have there that would maybe make this thing as a sort of an one future step. It's actually a long time in the future, maybe not completely crazy. Yeah? And with this, I would like to pass these things on to Hans-Peter, who can now tell you about these three-body interaction ideas.
Thank you. So. Yeah, so during the last part, I would like to tell you how we can use now these polar molecules to design three-body interactions and to design specific four-body interactions. And in general, what does one want to do if one wants to get higher body interaction is that one has a system which is our ground state, which is describes the low energy manifold of the particles, and one has some high energy excitations which are essentially, which can be coupled by an interaction Hamiltonian. And now doing perturbation theory, or in other words, integrating out these high energy excitations, one arrives at effective low energy Hamiltonians for the system below here. Now in general we know this, and we can do this for the Hubbard model for fermions, which then maps to the TJ model, or if one starts with the Kitaev model and on a Hubbard comp like this, one can map it to the toric chord by doing perturbation theory. And this is essentially the method to induce higher order interactions. The advantage with cold polar molecules is that we have many degrees of freedom up here, and we have the possibility to tune these interactions and to tune the strength of these couplings. And the main point is that we have here typical characteristic energy scales which are hopping, which are onset interactions, for example for bosons in an optical lattice, and there's a huge scale of order of magnitude difference which is described by different internal states. So we have internal structure for polar molecules which gives us different scale in energy to integrate out and derive effective Hamiltonians without having to use already our ability for designing hopping energies. So what type of Hamiltonians will be achieved with this method? So it will arrive at Hubbard models. The bosons will be hardcore bosons for reasons, for technical reasons, I will tell you. So we have a hopping energy, we have an on-site nearest neighbor interaction, and we have free body interactions, and so next nearest neighbor interactions which will decay with a certain power law. And so this, the dominant free body interactions would pay us if we go on a honeycomb like this, will forbid free particles to sit close to each other. So we will have a large energy penalty for free particles close to each other, but if two particles are close to each other, we are completely free to tune it. So the nearest neighbor interaction U can be made zero, can be made attractive or repulsive. And the most important point is, because we are dealing with polar molecules, the interaction strength can be very strong. So even if we choose a hopping energy of 0.1 recoil energy, which is the characteristic energy scale for atomic and molecular physics, we can make the free body interactions order of 30 larger than the hopping energy, and even the two body interactions can be of the order of 300 larger than the hopping energy. So it really allows to go into the strong coupling limits without having to quench the hopping energy essentially to zero. And so these energy scales are still of the order of kilohertz and are not, as mentioned before, repeated of the order of hertz. Now let me go a little bit into the technical details, how one can actually achieve this procedure. So we have the polar molecules, have been explained by Peter Solow, where we have the n equals zero, the ground state, the rotational ground state. We neglect spin in our system, so we don't have hyperfine spins, and we just have the rotation of the polar molecules. As can be, for example, achieved for all polar molecules out of alkali metals, like cesium, lithium, rubidium, lithium, which all have no additional electronic spin, and therefore well described by the rotor alone. Now, the advantage of this rotor level is that we can couple it by microwave fields. We can apply static fields to couple these levels in addition, and because we have microwave fields, we have no spontaneous emission. So if we want to play these tools by coupling different electronic levels for atoms, then it immediately tells us that an excited atomic state decays on nanoseconds via spontaneous emission, which will kill immediately this playground, which we can play here. So it's really important that in contrast to atoms, where the first excitations are electronic excitations, which will have a very high spontaneous emission rate, for polar molecules, the coupling here is possible, and the spontaneous emission rate is low. So we can now focus on the ground state with n equals 0, and the first excited state with n equals 1. Applying a static electric field along the z directions, we split the first excited manifold, and applying then, in addition, a microwave field allows to couple the ground state with the first excited state. And we choose a circular polarized microwave field to couple the mz equals 0 component with the mz equals 1 component. Now, one still sees that these two states will be degenerate, but for simplicity, I will only focus on these two states. The analysis can be performed, including the general state here, or there are other methods to shift this state away. So don't be confused. I will now restrict analysis to these two states. So by applying now a microwave field, we couple the ground state with the excited states. The detuning to the next state is much larger, and someone can neglect all other states and restrict the analysis to these two states. And yeah, these are essentially my states I have told you. So a combination of this ground and excited state will be the low energy manifold, and the other combination of ground and excited state will be the high state manifold, and the coupling between the two will be the dipole-dipole interaction. And so we can write down the effective Hamiltonian. So we have the motion of the polar molecules, which is the kinetic energy here. We have the trapping energy, which gives rise to optical lattices and can confine the system into two dimensions or one-dimensional cubes. We have the internal energy for each polar molecules. Within a rotating wave, is described essentially as a spin, which is the ground state and excited states corresponding to spin down and spin up. And the microwave coupling corresponds to an effective magnetic field applied. This state has two eigenstates, with eigenstate with plus energy and with minus energy. And in the following, we will prepare the system where all polar molecules are essentially in a plus state with these parameters alpha and beta. And now we can write down the dipole interaction in these spaces and do perturbation theory on this dipole-dipole interaction, coupling the different states and providing an effective interaction for all polar molecules in this plus state. The dipole-dipole has two parts. We have polarized the atoms by applying a static electric field, which gives us the term here, where mu of r is the standard dipole-dipole interaction. And the strength of it depends on the strength of the electric field we have applied. In addition, we have essentially exchange interaction, which means that a polar molecule in the ground state and a polar molecule in excited state have a strong interaction by exchanging a photon such that the polar molecules in excited state goes to the ground state and the one in the ground state goes into the excited state. And this exchange interaction takes the form of coupling of spin raising and spin lowering operator. So we have a S plus moving the polar molecules from the ground state in excited state, and S minus doing the reverse at a different position. And again, we have the dipole-dipole interaction. However, because we use a zero polarized light, we see that the two parameters have a different sign. So one is a positive dipole-dipole interaction, while the other is a negative part. Now one can derive the effective von Oppenheimer curves, which means we fix the interparticle positions, integrate out the internal degree of freedom, which gives us the energy of the internal states, and then this energy depends on the position of all particles, and we interpret this energy as the effective potential for the particles. So the position dependence of the energy levels for the internal structure defines us the interaction between the particles. An assumption is that the particles adiabatically follow within this curve, which gives rise to this energy-dependent energy curve. And it turns out that this adiabatic approximation is very good as long as my particles are far enough apart. And the condition that they are far enough apart is given by the strength of the dipole-dipole interaction and the detuning we apply. And this parameter we can tune. And so by crunching the system a little bit closer to this adiabatic point, we can make the effect of this interaction stronger. And so we do exactly this procedure, fix the particle positions, integrate out the internal states, diagonalize this matrix, and write down the effective potential which we obtain. And there is an expansion parameter, so we can do it in second order perturbation theory, and we obtain the following potential. So we have a leading toward particle interaction potential, and in addition, we get the free body interaction potential. Now the two particle consists of two terms. The first is the standard dipole-dipole interaction, but there is a second term which comes via a perturbation theory order of magnitude higher. And this, we see, is then a dipole-dipole interaction squared, but including the second order also induces a free body interaction. And the nice thing is that because we have dipole-dipole interactions in analogy to NMR experiments, where we know that it is possible that dipole-dipole interactions in spin systems can be cancelled by applying a magic frequency rotation, so one rotates the sample at the magic frequency, and it turns out that this allows to cancel exactly dipole-dipole interaction. And the same happens here, so we have a static dipole-dipole, and we have microwave-induced dipole-dipole interaction, which means that this lambda 2 can be changed from 0 to attractive and to repulsive. So we have a complete freedom in changing these parameters. Now, the problem is that, as I told you, we have to have the polar molecules far apart, which restricts the validity of this procedure. And the method which guarantees that the particles do never approach each other is that actually these potential curves become repulsive if the particles get in shorter distances, which quenches the probability to be on shorter distances, and one can estimate actually the tunneling rate that two polar molecules get close to each other. And for strong dipole-dipole interactions, one can show that this probability for two polar molecules approaching each other is quenched. And so one can really use these effective interactions to derive, to play with it, and derive now Bose-Hallward model. Now, one can also study, keep the system in free space and not applying a periodic lattice. This will give rise to lattice structure, as was explained by Peter Solo. But let me now go back and say what happens if we apply an optical lattice. So we have, Peter has already explained how an optical lattice works. Let me skip this slide and go directly to the part. So we apply the standard procedures to map this Hamiltonian to the Bose-Hallward model, where we now have the Hopping energy, the two-particle interaction, which is the two-particle interactions we have in free space between the particles, and the remaining free-body interactions, which comes from the free-body interactions between the particles. And we have a high tunability by changing the Rabi frequency of the microwave transition, changing the detuning, or changing the strength of the electric field. We can tune these effective coupling parameters. Important is that these free body interactions have not extremely fast decay for larger distances. So they decay like a dipole-dipole interactions with 1 over r to the cubed. However, scales, for example, for lithium-cesiums, shows that we can really achieve very strong interactions in the system. And as a first application, one can ask what interesting solid state physics model can we achieve with it. So we can go to an interesting solid state physics model and ask, can we achieve this with these parameters? And one example is, for example, supersolids on a triangular lattice, where it has been studied that for hardcore bosons with an on-site nearest neighbor, with infinite on-site interactions and finite nearest neighbor interaction, the system exhibits a supersolid phase at a filling which is at half filling of the lattice. And inserting now the parameters for our system, we can really show that we can achieve the strong nearest neighbor attraction which is necessary to go into the supersolid phase. What is still missing is the question whether these long-range dipole-dipole interactions has a fast enough decay to guarantee that we are in a supersolid phase. But the hope is that because we can tune these parameters so highly, that we can also change interactions to 1 to the R6 dependence, with this method we can really achieve a supersolid phase. Alternatively, one can ask, how does the simplest model look with free-body interactions? So one can start studying the pure free-body interactions in a 1D system, which has again the Hopping energy, the simplest free-body interactions, which tells us that free particles next to each other are forbidden, and at the moment, let's neglect the next nearest neighbor interactions. Then there is the possibility, because we are in 1D, to do bosonizations, and it shows us that there are some surprising phases appearing, namely that there are, in analogy to the Mott superfluid transition, there will be crystalline phases. the trivial crystalline phase is that we have two molecules sitting next to each other, and then we cannot occupy the next side because this causes the free body interaction. So then comes a hole, and then again two polar molecules sitting next to each other, a hole again, and again two polar molecules. So this, this structure of the crystal already represents the strong dependence of free body interaction. If you now go to hole filling, it's more surprising that there will appear crystalline structures which do not modulate the density, which means that at hole filling we get the crystal where the particles actually hop a lot between two neighboring sides, but the, which gives a correlation in a hopping amplitude, but the filling is completely uniform. So with that, one sees that actually free body can give rise to interesting phases. And certainly there's the paper by Chaitin Nayak, where they have argued to achieve string nets in a system, one has to go to free body interactions. And here I will show a possible scenario to achieve a string net configurations. However, I want to remind you that I neglect nearest neighbor interactions. So I will just throw away all next nearest neighbor interactions and just keep the dominant term of the free body interactions and show you an idea how one in principle can go towards string nets with this additional interaction. So the idea is that we start with the system, we fill on a honeycomb lattice, so we start the system, fill each lattice site with one atom per lattice site, then we map the system to an effective spin system by doubling this two-dimensional layer. So we split each site where an atom is sitting into two lattice sites, which means we split this, we have this 2D layer in a honeycomb lattice. Now we split this 2D layer into two layers, and so because we have start with integer filling, we have now sometimes an atom is in the lower side and sometimes it's in the upper side. And so we can map it to a spin system by saying that if a particle is in the upper side, it's spin up. If it is in the lower side, it's spin down. Now if we choose the magic angle of cosine theta equal 1 over 3, then we know that dipole-dipole interaction vanishes, which means that these two particles are completely non-interacting due to the anisotropy of the dipole-dipole interaction. And now using this effective Hamiltonian tells us that it is forbidden either having three particles in the upper plane next to each other or three particles in the lower plane next to each other. Or in other words, it tells us that the forbidden configurations are spin systems, so we project out all spin configurations where if I count the total spin of three neighboring sides, the total spin is either plus 3 over 2 or is minus 3 over 2. And as was explained by this nice paper by Chaitin Nayak, this condition is enough actually to map the system to string nets. So the degeneracy of this interaction Hamiltonian would be a string net with three couplings. One can easily understand it by saying that the honeycomb is a bipartite lattice, so we label each lattice site by two different types of structures, and saying that a string, so we draw a string if we go from one spin down side to a spin up side and back to a spin down side. And one sees immediately that this string can never end, because if it wants to end, we would need here also a particle in spin up state, which is forbidden by this condition. And so the string has to continue because here has also become a great particle. And this allows, for example, to map the system to such string nets. Now I see my time is nearly over, and I was planning to tell you also shortly something about the ring exchange. Now I fear that you all are extremely hungry, so let me just very shortly, what is the idea? It was also mentioned in the previous talk that if we, okay, it's a huge step now. Now, I'm not so sure, so, okay. So let me skip this and whoever is interested, I'm welcome to discuss this after my talk. And I will jump to the conclusions. So that polar molecules allows for designing crystals structure, allows, as Pete has told you, design systems which have much shorter lattice spacing. We can design in these systems free body interactions and design extended Hubbard models. And the part which I've not shown you, that actually it's possible in atomic physics via lattice resonances to design ring exchange interaction, which is essentially also, if I would express it in spin language, a forward interaction. And so, thank you much for your attention.